part that you played in the introduction of the doctrine of metempsychosis among the Greeks. On a religious level, where his emphasis upon the unity of world religions, his vast traveling, which brought him into direct contact with the great religious systems of his time, and the mystical disciplines which were practiced in the university which he established at Crotona. Thus we have a man whose achievements cover an unusually broad range, and as a result, his memory has passed through many vicissitudes in the descent of time. Those who admired his scientific achievements are inclined to question his philosophical attainments or to doubt his religious opinions. Yet all in all, a grateful world has honored him, and perhaps through a better understanding of his philosophy, some of the doubts and uncertainties concerning his various contributions can be brought into focus, clarified, and something added in this century to the luster which already surrounds his illustrious name. Our discussions in these talks will be principally with the mathematical philosophy of Pythagoras, which also divides into two essential parts, one of which may be termed theoretical and the other practical. On the practical level, Pythagoras made the greatest contribution of the ancient world to the advancement of the science of mathematics. He is responsible for the later achievements of Euclid, who in turn has influenced all mathematical thinkers down to the present day. If it had not been for Pythagoras and Euclid, there might not have been a Steinmetz or an Einstein. The great development of mathematics rested, therefore, upon the practical findings of Pythagoras and the philosophy of number upon his philosophical speculations. Pythagoras was one of the first, if not the first, to emphasize the importance of number and mathematics in the advancement of the total state of man's integration. He was loath to assume that so noble a science, so magnificent a system, was devised simply for the convenience of the banker and the money changer. The purpose of mathematics was to unfold through orderly instruments man's internal consciousness of the universe around him and the psychic life within him. Thus to Pythagoras, mathematics was part of religion, part of philosophy, part of all those great ideals, those great systems of human thought which have enriched and cultured, cultivated, and civilized the conduct of human beings. This evening we are going to discuss, first of all, the Pythagorean concept of numeration and number. And in this, we come to the theoretical phase of the master's work. We are interested in this phase because certainly it is possible to progress in the science of mathematics for a practical purpose by attending many schools or by a moderate study of mathematical textbooks. For the most part, however, progression of this kind does not include the philosophy of number or the great imponderables relating to the universal mystery, which Pythagoras regarded as the essence and substance of all mathematical speculation. Thus, we must understand not only something of the numbers as taught by Pythagoras, but something of the philosophy which he interpreted through number, and which has become identical with the numerical speculation for the majority of those who have studied his system. To begin with, then, Pythagoras recognized the existence of a primary and basic concept in mathematics, which he called archetypal number. Archetypal number, as the term itself indicates, is a concept of numeration which exists in the divine mind. As archetypes are patterns or designs, which when impressed upon substances result in the gradual unfoldment of orderly sequences. So archetypal number represents the key to the great design of being. It represents and unfolds the entire theory of existence and enables the individual, through the study of archetypal number, to apprehend or apperceive the basic function of the divine mind. Thus, to Pythagoras, numeration was a kind of mathematics existing only in the consciousness of God. And mathematics themselves, the various branches of arithmetical science, these branches represent these archetypal or divine numbers shadowed forth into the mundane world and becoming the guiding principle, the controlling design, affecting the unfoldment, growth, evolution, and progress of every living thing. Thus he distinguished what he called numeration, which is a descent of number in principle. And he also represented or recognized numbers themselves, which in their turn were a descent of numeration on the objective level of numerical division. Thus, if we approach the concept of numeration, we must approach the basic definition of deity as understood in the Pythagorean system. What is numeration, and how does it differ from number? Numeration is number in principio. Numeration is a concept of number, but is not number itself. When we say God is one, we are really thinking in terms of numeration. One, in this case, is a concept of totality, not a concept of unit or a concept of first or a concept of an isolated numerical one. When we say that the end of human experience is union with the divine, we are thinking now of a concept of union based upon the concept of unity, and unity is again a numerational concept of oneness. Yet unity is not one. You wouldn't say 2 plus unity equals 3. You wouldn't think that way. Unity has a different connotation. Unity is one, but it is a totality. Unity is one in the term of the annihilation of interval, because things which are in a state of unity are in a state of identity, a state of sameness, or a state of assimilation by which all division or separateness between them can no longer be conceived or calculated. Therefore, unity is the restoration of all division, the reestablishment of totality as a concept. Man himself has never seen totality, because regardless of what he may see, the unseen must also be conceived as existing. And totality must be the complete unity of the seen and the unseen. It must be the complete identity of the known and the unknown. Therefore, man may not perceive it, but man may conceive it. Yet even in his conception thereof, there is a limitation, and his conception is empiric. That is, it is an assumption based upon the acceptance of the concept or the statement that the known plus the unknown equals one. Now this is a concept that carries us into one of the deepest abstractions of thought, and we find it restored to us in a great school of Indian thought, the school of yoga. Yoga means union. It means the state or consciousness of oneness. Now, oneness in the search of by man for the nature of truth assumes this condition of an at-one-ment. It is the concept of an ultimate state achieved by a progressive annihilation of diversity or intervals, by which gradually the human being achieves a state of identity with total existence. All these things are words, but words in turn are symbols of ideas. Ideas are in man the shadows of archetypes, because according to these concepts, the universe, creation itself, existence, manifested being, are all suspended from eternal ideas in the divine mind. Man attempting to understand God and himself engenders within his own intellect shadowy ideas which are archetypal but not complete, but which do indicate to a limited degree the probable direction of the divine mind. Numeration, then, differs from number inasmuch as it represents in every instance either unity itself or aggregations of the parts of unity no longer arranged side by side, but conceived as a new unity composed of divided parts. Let us then assume that we have in our hand a number of straws, and we will say that we count these straws and we find that we have 12. Now this immediately creates the possibility of two concepts of the nature of 12. One of these concepts is that we are holding in our hand 12 separate straws. Therefore, we can conceive of 12 as a symbol to represent a dozen of anything. 12 matches, $12, 12 straws. These are a group or a specified number of these items. And 12 things may not all be alike. We may hold 12 objects, all of different categories, and call them also 12, unless we wish to distinguish in greater detail by saying that 4 of these objects are lemons, 2 are oranges, and 6 are apples. Thus, we have ways of distinguishing types within number, but we are dealing with 12 things. Now, there is another way of conceiving of this. Because when 12 objects are brought together, they produce a grouping for which a single term is applicable. When we hold out 12 objects in our hands, we don't point at them and say 1111111111111 so many times. We say 12. And at the moment we say 12, a numerical concept arises in the consciousness of the person we address. And we transfer the concept of this group as a collective. And we know that the number 12 is capable of stimulating an idea. And that this idea is not 12 separate parts, primarily, but is a unit called 12. That this unit has a nature of its own, dimensions, boundaries, proportions, and is applicable only to a certain order or numerical group. If we remove one of these straws, the total number 12 is destroyed, and a new number is created, and that number is 11. And 11 is also a unit, a oneness, a totality composed of the 11 separate parts. Therefore, all groups may be considered as composed of separate parts, or may be considered as units or unities composed of a certain number of related elements or members. Thus, 12 is a numeration. 12 ones, considered separately, constitute numbers. The 12 is an idea which conveys to us oneness composed of 12 parts, whereas the parts themselves do not convey oneness, nor necessarily imply it. For they may be separate when so considered, but when grouped, they engender a new idea which is the sum of themselves. Now, Pythagoras made a great point of this on a philosophical level. It might not seem to be important at the beginning, but I think you will see how it gains importance as we proceed. So we begin now with the first of the Pythagorean mathematical concept, which may be called unity or the monad. Now, unity is a term applicable to God, and therefore the Pythagoreans did not properly regard it as a number. They considered it the first motion of being, and the first expression of the universal consciousness. For the first conceivable or apperceivable quality of the divine nature is unity. Now, unity in this case is a single term covering what we term the phenomenon of ultimate and absolute diversity. We think of deity as being the total of all its parts, the complete essence of creation. And we think of God as that immense and incalculable being in whom we live and move and have our existence. Therefore, actually, the complete unit, the complete monad, the one which is all. Now, the one which is all may likewise be conceived of geometrically as a sphere, for the reason that a sphere is a geometrical solid with an infinite number of surfaces. In other words, the assumption is that there is an inconceivable number of flat planes in the structure of a circle, and that this circle, therefore, is unlimited or eternal in its surfacing, and also the sphere rests upon the least hypothetical surface of its own nature, the sphere of all geometrical forms, rests upon the least part of itself, and also is the most immediately subjected to motion. And the sphere moves wherever the surface upon which it is placed is in any way unbalanced. This is again a Pythagorean theorem, because to the Pythagoreans, the first motion of being is due to the uneven nature of eternal surface upon which the sphere operates or moves. And you can see how these different principles become involved in a variety of ideas. Now Pythagoras, beginning with the numeration of the monad, or of the unit, began in this way to philosophize. What is there in nature that is outside of or beyond the nature of infinite being? Pythagoras defined God as an infinite being whose body was composed of the substance of life and whose soul was composed of the substance of truth. This definition perhaps is one of the noblest and the most splendid that we have in philosophical history. Conceiving deity to be infinite, and to conceive that there could be no interval in the nature of deity, no restriction upon the infinite manifestation of infinite being. Pythagoras, conceiving the deity and the monad, or the unit, to be similar or identical, or at least in proximity to each other theoretically, came to the conclusion that the one, or the monad, the unit, the totality, is the only numeration that can exist per se without qualification, limitation, or restriction. It is also the only immortal number, the only eternal numeration, inasmuch as it is the only thing which cannot be destroyed. Totality is indestructible, inasmuch as all destruction, so called, is the reduction of part within totality. In other words, any creature can die, and its body can be returned to the various elements from which it came. And the soul may return to the sidereal powers from which it came. But this destruction or disintegration of body is merely the dissolving of a compound. Nothing is lost. Everything remains in the universe. All forms are subject to change, but nothing is destructible, in the sense of being susceptible of annihilation. The only thing which is not subject to change, and therefore subject to what we call destruction, is totality, inasmuch as there can never be less than all, there can never be more than all, nothing can be added to all, and nothing can be taken from all. All cannot be multiplied, nor can it be divided or in any way qualified. Thus, allness, or the state of totality, is a term to be given at all times to the sum of all conceivable and inconceivable parts. And these parts, regardless of their number, regardless of their multiplication, regardless of infinite generation, infinitely diversifying them in time and space, whenever you put the parts together, the term all is suitable. Whether this all is made of three parts or of 3 million parts,
The sum of parts is always all. Therefore, we have a conceptual allness. Now, allness being monad, or unity, and not being susceptible of division, because to divide God is to destroy God. To divide unity, theoretically, is to annihilate it or destroy it. And as it is by nature indestructible, it cannot be divided. And consequently, it is impossible for totality to ever exceed unity, or unity to ever exceed totality. Now, this may not seem to be leading anywhere in particular, except into deep water, but it is leading somewhere, as we'll try to point out, because we are coming now to one of the most difficult and tricky problems with which thinkers have been confronted since the dawn of time. Unity or totality existing forever and eternally in its own nature is said to rest or to be without the quality of motion. For where can the all move? Being all, it cannot move from place to place, because all is within place, and place is within all, and they are identical. All can neither increase nor decrease in totality. It can neither divide nor subtract. Nor can it at any time be less than itself. Nor can it at any time generate creatures inferior to itself. Nor can it at any time create a creature or a being which has an interval between itself and totality. Those are the qualities and attributes of totality itself. We could never travel so far into space that we could get beyond the circumference of being. Therefore, we can never depart from it, nor can we ever approach it more intimately, because its center is everywhere. Thus, the concept of unity, or of the monad, the more we study it and the more we analyze it, enlarges our entire appreciation of the nature of God by projecting this appreciation onto a mathematical scale or level, and achieving more and more, by thoughtfulness, extraordinary penetration into the theory of pure number. Yet Pythagoras and everyone else was well aware of the fact that from this immense and immeasurable source, from this indivisible root and cause, the phenomenon of apparent diversity emanated, and numeration set in motion became number, and number in its own motion produced the numerals, or the numerations, which were the Pythagorean symbols for the infinite diversity of life. What then is the answer? And Pythagoras pointed out, since diversity must exist, and since unity cannot be divided, nor can the sum of diversity ever exceed unity, it therefore becomes obvious that what we call diversity is not a division of unity, but a division within unity, and that there can be never any other number than one, and that number one itself cannot substantially even be a number, because it is always a total idea. Yet this total idea cannot be shaken, cannot be disrupted, cannot be weakened in the consciousness of man. Consequently, the only possibility of the generation of number is by a segmentation within the concept of unity. Pythagoras then began to examine the concept of the duad, the two, or the numeration of division. And to him, the duad, or the two, was the archetypal form of division. And as this archetypal form of division could have no subsistence in itself, could exist only by virtue of the parental monad, and its powers, therefore, were always inferior to those of its own generating source, the duad could not divide the monad, and therefore two totalities could not come into existence. Two can never, therefore, be the double of the one. This attacks the basic concept that we have in theology of anthropomorphism, in which we oppose a principle of good and evil and cause these to battle through the ages and through the millennia of time for supremacy over the world. Pythagoras said that deity is the one to which there can be no essential two. Therefore, what is the two? And Pythagoras, following perhaps some of his Brahmin masters at Ellora or Elephanta, declared the two to be the root of illusion. And whenever the number was referred to in the school, the master or the disciple, using the word, spat upon the ground to indicate his rejection of the original concept involved. Two is a very interesting and important problem, but we have to approach it somewhat carefully because we must first of all try to understand with Pythagoras how the concept of the monad can produce within itself the concept of the duad. It does so by recognizing the possibility of unity consisting of any conceivable or inconceivable number of parts. And these parts, regardless of their number, are summarized by the concept of part, or the concept of a partial existence, all of which pertains to the number two. Two, consequently, represents any possible, conceivable appearance of disunity which may exist in space. It means, for instance, that when we see two ones side by side and we unite them by holding them together and we call them two, the name two pertains to our illusional or materialistic lack of internal understanding. Because a two composed of parts brought together is not a two, but a monad. It is one. So what is two as we are holding two objects in our hands? Two is one in the term of halves. Thus, no matter the number of parts involved, the triad, or the three, is one in the term of thirds. The tetrad, or the four, is one in terms of fourths. Because the moment we say four, we give the number of parts. The moment we say tetrad, we give the name for the unity of those parts. Therefore, all numerations are names for unity when conceived of as consisting of parts. The consciousness of this leads then to the recollection or the recognition of the restoration of unity through the reintegration of their parts. All division lies in the acceptance of the classification of number. All unity in the acceptance of the classification of numeration. Thus, if we are advancing politically, sociologically, culturally, if we are trying to overcome religious prejudices or racial prejudices or cultural intervals, we are constantly seeking to reestablish unity. And this unity is the internal comprehension of the idea behind the concept of separation. Unless the idea is there and active, we are unaware of the fact that all divided parts, when brought together, create unity. And that unities of various sizes, numbers, and orders, by their further gatherings and minglings, create still greater unities. And these unities, in turn, unite to form more magnificent unities, until finally all converge in total unity. Thus the universe is an ascending order of unities, composed of lesser parts, and themselves the lesser parts of greater unities. All unities, therefore, regarded or contemplated from levels below themselves, have one nature or appearance, and when conceived from levels above themselves, have another nature or appearance. A unity, when conceived from a level below itself, appears to be an aggregate of separate parts. When seen from a level above itself, it is a unity composed of separate parts. The superior always conceives the unity, or discovers it, or experiences it, whereas the inferior sees the parts but is unable to conceive the unity. Thus, if we look upon 12 from below, we see 12 separate parts. If we look at 12 from a superior position, we see unity manifesting through the numeral 12. This is a matter of perspective, and here we open another vast pageant of speculation. Man, looking upward to the aggregates of unities above himself, calls them gods. And these gods, in turn, looking toward the unity which transcends themselves, calls this sovereign unity being, or the supreme and one God above all division. The universe, then, like the original cell of the human body, it is never in itself divided by nature or substance. But as cell multiplication takes place within the first fecundated cell, until finally the entire body develops within the original cell and never departs from it, so surely the infinite diversity of creation occurs within the original cell, which is unity, which is being, which is the indivisible nature of deity itself. Thus we have now the recognition that all division consists of a hypothetical division within eternal and real unity, and that division exists only in the consciousness of creatures on a lower level than the phenomena involved. For that which stands above diversity annihilates it. That which stands below diversity may be intellectually or spiritually annihilated by the sense of diversity, and therefore be unaware of the eternal unity. Though unity, or the monad, being in itself an indivisible, eternal, unconditioned, unlimited existence, properly signified by the sphere, the totality of all parts, all things being equidistant from the eternal central zone of consciousness, we have to recognize that deity is also susceptible of another meaning or another interpretation. For if God is one, or eternity, God is also one in the sense of the first, the superior, the most magnificent, that which excels all other things, and by its excellence, or by its primordial place, it gives us another concept of unity. Therefore, we may worship God with equal propriety, either as the All or the One. Now, in the nature of the One, what is different from the nature of totality? The nature of totality is complete inclusiveness. The nature of One represents a more or less complete exclusiveness. The One is the superior. It is the greatest. It is the first. Therefore, it represents not only total being, but the supreme excellence of a being. And in the concept of the human mind, there is this almost inevitable alternation between conceiving the Supreme Being as all or one. As one, as the first, as the primordial, it may properly be placed in the center of the circle or the hypothetical sphere of existence in the form of a dot, and we create a very simple universal mathematical symbol, often applied by primitive people to the sun, and still so used in astronomical symbolism, namely a dot in a circle. This dot in the circle tells us one in all, and also by reverse, all in one. The dot tells us that the inconceivable, immeasurable, incalculable totality of being does not itself change, but man, in his effort to conceive of this, and being unable to assume total consciousness, attempts to define the all by bestowing upon it certain singular attributes by which it achieves uniqueness of concept. And this uniqueness of concept is the first departure of man into the realm of relative thinking. When we think of God as unique, we think of God as set apart from all things. If we think of God as unit, we think of God as all things, the total and entire substance of all parts. Thus, in the concept of uniqueness, we strangely transform or deform the concept of unity, and we come gradually to the recognition of God no longer as being, but as a being. no longer as principle, but as a principle. No longer as consciousness, but as a consciousness. And this by itself is a division, a reduction, by which totality is destroyed. And we have a being, or a total unit established, surrounded by an abyss of a non-identical nature. The moment we conceive of a superior or unique being, we create this concept by differentiating it from all other things. And in so doing, we create polarity. And we have a being and not being. Not being, being, of course, by nature and substance, the dark background, or the background of the concept of a being which we have created within ourselves. Thus, the moment we create a God or a God concept, we bring inevitably into existence the not God concept. And the most primary concept that we have of this is the hypothetical division of spirit and matter. Thus, duality, or the two, represented to the Pythagoreans spirit and matter, light and darkness, male and female, life and death, representing all polarized existences. The positive pole of these existences being conceived as a reality, and the negative pole as a shadow or non-substance, deprived of that which is the essential nature of substance. Some ancient theologists and mythologists conceived that originally the universe was an infinite expanse of being, and that gradually this infinite expanse retired, or, so to say, restricted itself toward its own center, creating an effulgent spiritual existence, and leaving the area from which it had retired deprived of its own nature, leaving, therefore, darkness behind it, or the not-self in the great space left by the withdrawal of being to form a being, or a center of consciousness, or consciousness as a self-consciousness in space. If then we have self-consciousness, we must also have an interval of some nature, for self can only be unique because it is separate from or different from other selves. And man, in his gradual development of his innate egoism, has come to this curious psychological situation in which uniqueness is the experience within each psychic entity, and each individual feels strangely that he is unique, that the divine or essential spark within himself is a separate and distinct spark with a separate and distinct destiny. And upon this concept, the whole conception of Western philosophy and Western theology has been built. Because it is this concept which makes this unique self capable of separation in quality from being, therefore capable of ignorance, capable of violation of the law of being, therefore capable of sin and crime. And because it has a separate existence, and because no separate existence is eternal, the complex of selfhood brings with it the inevitable fear of death. Because death is inescapable where a condition of uniqueness or a separateness of one thing from another exists. For uniqueness to be sustained must imply a constant conflict between itself and the not-self which surrounds it. And this conflict ends finally in the exhaustion of selfhood, because the spark of self in each creature is infinitely outnumbered by the incalculable area of not-self. And the self is but a spark in an infinite expanse of space, which is forever closing in upon that sense of selfhood. Thus the self cannot have a victory over totality, but must finally be exhausted in its psychological conflict with totality, and be returned again to the state of totality. Just as all buildings built by man upon the earth will ultimately rot back into the earth from which they came, just as all worlds and planets must ultimately return to the space from which they came, all conditioned beings, by being conditioned, are mortal, and must therefore return to an unconditioned state, which to our unenlightened intellect means extinction. This conditioned space, then, now becomes the hypothetical Pythagorean duad. It is the one in the term of halves. And wherever we have this one in the term of halves, the positive pole assumes the dynamic position, becoming the agent. The negative pole assumes the static position and becomes the patient. Therefore, agent and patient are in contrast to each other through all eternity. The agent and patient, in this case, may be regarded as spirit and matter, or they may be regarded as intellect and form. But by whatever nature we wish to recognize, the Pythagoreans insisted that the acceptance of the concept of duality and the projection of categories based upon duality and the unfoldment of syllogisms based upon duality, all of these resulted in the mind gradually descending into a state of illusion, inasmuch as the existence of selfhood itself is a primary illusion. And from this one basic illusion, all others naturally follow. This is essentially the teaching of Buddha, who was convinced that the acceptance of the illusion of personal divinity or personal self either must ultimately lead to the complete corruption of the internal consciousness of man. Now, if we have the monad as all consciousness, then the diversity, the duad, gives us self-consciousness and unconsciousness. Self-consciousness is the term that we naturally bestow upon our own field of conscious awareness. Unconsciousness is the mysterious sea in which each one of us tries to swim. For unconsciousness is nothing more nor less than the consciousness of all things except ourselves, which we, not being able to know, appreciate, or understand, must naturally regard as mysterious, unknowable, vague, dark, beyond comprehension. Thus, in psychology, we approach the same essential problem. When the psychologist refers to the unconscious, it is not immediately evident, either to himself or anyone else, whether he refers to that which is unconscious in space, or that of which he is unconscious, but which may, in its own nature, be superlatively conscious. Thus, we also have another important fragment from the Pythagorean logic on these matters. For we know that there is nothing more mysterious to any individual than the thoughts of his neighbor. Not one of us knows with certainty what anyone else thinks or believes. So we have a little spark of light which we call our own thinking, which is constantly surrounded by a strange darkness, which is the thinking of every other person. And this thinking of every other person, when gathered together, as far as our experience is concerned, is no thinking, because we cannot share in it. We cannot participate in it. It has no mental or visual imaging power within ourselves. We can see other persons, and we can assume that they are thinking. But if we could not see them, and they were of a substance different from ourselves, we would not even assume that they were thinking or that they even had a mental existence. Therefore, all bodies which surround us, which are not visible to us, or are by magnitude or multitude so remote as to be beyond comprehension, are by ourselves assumed to be mindless, because we are unable to conceive of their intellectual activity. The illusion rests, then, in this very simple point, namely, that to each person, every other person is unreal. It means, then, that in this concept there can be no reality. For if we are real to ourselves, we are part of everyone else's unreality. And this concept must lead us to the inevitable conclusion that we are actually living not in a world in which we as a self can be in any way unique, but that this uniqueness is a delusion of our own, and that every other living thing is equally unique. And the totality of this uniqueness is unity, which is substantially indivisible anyway. The uniqueness is only our own point of view, which is obviously stupid when we consider it for any extended length of time. Thus, uniqueness is only our own egotistic assumption. And when all the rest of the world has the same attitude, then everyone is unique to himself and non-existent to everyone else. Here we have the center also of another kind of universe, the universe of illusion, in which its center also is everywhere and its circumference nowhere. It is exactly the reverse of the great circumference of reality. The duad, by nature then, representing a certain inharmonious maladjustment of understanding or lack of understanding, was, according to the Pythagoreans, the first apperceptible number. The monad was really too sacred to be a number, because the moment you put the number one on it, you created uniqueness and destroyed it. Therefore, neither the one nor the monad should be considered as numbers. They should be considered as principles abiding forever in eternity. Two, as diversity, is thus the first of the true numbers, because diversity is the first aspect of being of which man is aware, and of which he is able to have a certain rational cognition. And of this, then, Pythagoras said, the monad is intellect, the duality is science, the triad is opinion, and the tetrad is sense. And we have this descent of powers.